inherits gained hastily at the beginning will not be blessed at the end.
All right. An inheritance gained hurriedly at the beginning. What is that called? When, what is this speaking to? When you gain a bunch quickly in the beginning. Powerball. Yeah, it's called Powerball, right? It's called $1.6 billion, right? So that person's going to walk home. I think we were doing the math and reading all the news articles with like 560 some odd million dollars. It's a lot of money. Are there, like, what do you... it's not enough.
They split it three ways because there wasn't there three winners.
I keep hearing like a New York deal and then a California deal. So what's the word on that?
Tennessee.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes, it's Tennessee, Florida, and California.
Haley's been keeping up with it. She's got to buy her dog. So she's trying to find sources for income. Wow. What was it? $200 million apiece if it split three ways? It's a lot of cash. So did you guys see, speaking of the article that Mark Cuban posted regarding that? He was talking about happiness and like, advice to the person who wins the Powerball lottery. It was fascinating. Just down to earth. He's like, look, if you're not happy now, you're not going to be happy later. It's just money. He's like, if you're happy now, you're going to be a lot happier later because it's money. And life's a lot easier when you don't have to pay bills, right? He's like, hire a tax attorney. I mean, just, I'm like, this is brilliant. From a fellow billionaire, good word, okay? But as we relate it to our proverb, from a parental perspective, what is that idea? An inheritance gained quickly. What is that called when you give your kid an inheritance gained quickly?
For your time?
Yeah. So what have they done to earn said inheritance? Nothing. What have you done to earn said inheritance as the parent?
Awesome.
You probably worked for it. You probably accumulated. And then you pass it on to your kid. And all the hard work that you've done, they don't have to do. Why would a parent spoil their kid? I mean, that's what it is, right? The spoils of victory are the things that you go in and earn or you get after a battle to spoil your kid. Why would a parent do that? What's the motivation out of that?
You want better for your child.
Yeah. It's ultimately out of love, right? You care for them. You want better for them. So you give them that. But the proverb says, ultimately, what happens with an inheritance gained too quickly?
Not be blessed in the
end. Why is that? Why is that a problem to end up with a lot that you didn't work for? You don't appreciate it. You don't understand the value of it, right? And even though a parent is desiring to bless their kids and love them and to give them maybe more than they had and give them a step up in life and set them off on a track of success, ultimately, God says, man, that plan doesn't work. It will not be blessed in the end. You guys have heard you guys know who Paul Harvey is? Any of you guys that are like 40 and older? He's an old guy from, thank you, Peggy. Some of you.
Always
kind of Peggy. My corner. Love you. He's a guy that was on the radio, and he's got those little tidbit sayings. I think, did you guys see the Super Bowl commercial years ago about, it's called the Farmer? That was Paul Harvey. Okay, that voice in the background, that story is Paul Harvey. He tells all kinds of those. Well, he tells the story of a guy who comes across a butterfly coming out of its cocoon. And the guy sees it, and it's struggling to get out, and he helps it, right? He tears the cocoon open and allows the butterfly to get out so it doesn't have to struggle. And he's sitting there watching the butterfly. A bird comes in and eats the butterfly. He's like, oh, well, that didn't work out so well. And he was telling his buddy about the situation, about what happened. And this guy who knew more about the situation than he did said, man, part of the life cycle of a butterfly, part of the importance of that butterfly getting out of the cocoon is the struggle. And if you don't allow the butterfly to struggle leaving the cocoon, it doesn't get all the mucus off its wings, and it inhibits it, and it makes it unable to fly. So this butterfly was certainly, or at this point now, basically a sitting duck, a turtle on its back because it couldn't fly and got eaten by a bird. And he said, you took away the most precious thing that butterfly has, which is the struggle. And if you don't allow that to happen, you basically retard the bird, or the butterfly in its growth, and it dies just like that, right? So as you think about that in terms of an inheritance gained too quickly, God as a loving father does not allow us to go through that process, right? He holds back on things that will ultimately harm us. And though we think that'd be great to have, you know, $600 million in our pocket tomorrow, and that'd be great, and, you know, we change the world and give it all away. And I'm sure some of us would be incredibly generous. I wouldn't. I'd hoard it all. Buy lots of canned chili or something. I don't know. Squirrel. God doesn't do that, right? And he's, as a loving father, remember that. There is something in the struggle that God honors, and he allows us to proceed through what we go through because that's ultimately to our benefit. So as you guys are working through life and just wishing that God would drop that, you know, big sack of money out of the sky or change life situations for whatever it may be, that ultimately doesn't get blessed in the end. You will understand the value of what God has allowed you to experience because you have not walked down those roads. And there is blessing and goodness in the struggle. It's part of the life cycle for all of us. As for a butterfly, the same is true for us. All right. So embrace wherever you may be at in that process. And remember that God has ordained that to be, and that struggle is part and parcel to the equipping and sharpening and godliness process in our life. All right. Other thoughts on that, or bemoanings, or what you would buy with $600 million? I don't think I'd want that money, in all honesty. Not that much.
I said $30 million.
Now. $30 million. I've got my standards. $30 million. We were talking about that life group the other night, and everyone was kind of sitting around giving that, oh, I wouldn't want an answer. And my wife's like, whatever. Give me the freaking money. I'd like to figure it out. Like, I want to try. I may be miserable, but I at least like to, you know, find out. Like, you know, that's an honest answer. So, good for you. So, all right. Let's go to Samson, shall we? Samson is one of my favorite characters in the book of Judges, and he's probably up there in the Old Testament. Favorite probably because he's a big warning sign. Samson is not maybe the guy that you've heard of in Sunday school, again, growing up, as we mentioned yesterday. He gets painted in a very good light, and there's some things about his life that are great and worth making note of and honoring, and there's some things in his life that are man, they should be signposts for you and I on the road of life, and to look at him and say, man, may my life not emulate some of those things. So as we dive into Samson, let's just kind of keep that in the forefront of our mind. Haley, pray for $600 million, and God bless your time. So chapter 13, let's pick up there. We see, again, as I mentioned yesterday, a couple judges that all get, you know, a verse or two in there. Some seem good, some bad. Verse 14 of chapter 12, you get this guy, Abdon, who's got 40 sons, 30 grandsons, 70 donkeys, reigns 8 years, lots of numbers, but not sure much about him. So these guys are kind of asides, if you will, in the midst of the story, probably have some significant stories to tell that aren't told. So talk to them when you get to heaven, figure out what they did, because I have no idea. Because that's all we got. Samson, on the other hand, gets a ton of press, okay? We're going to watch this guy from literally pre-birth to the end of his life, and we're going to see some amazing characteristics. We're going to see how this guy starts. We're going to see how he finishes in his whole life in three chapters. In my original Bible, when I was studying Samson in the context of a small group and being taught about this guy for the first time, I had like map colors for whatever reason, right? Red, yellow, and green. And I would write like next to each thing I saw about Samson, like things that were apparent in his life, I would just mark a color. Green, good, yellow, and red was clearly like, boy, that's sin and bad. And I was fascinated at the end of kind of studying this guy, how many yellow and red flags you see in this guy's life that go completely unchecked. Character qualities, things that are kind of lying underneath the surface in his life that are not pushed on, or he's too much of a big shot for people to push back on him, whatever it may be. And as you see then the end of his life, you see all these things that add up and you go, of course that's how his life ends, right? That makes sense with him. So Samson to me is a scary reminder of what God can do with a crooked stick, as we've used that phrase around here frequently. Samson is a mess, and God's going to use him, and he will rule Israel for 40 years in complete and utter sin. And it's frightening that that's the head of Israel, and that God uses this guy despite this guy. So be encouraged. It's not always the godly that God will use per se. God clearly is going to use this guy, and you're going to see this really weird tension with him of him being in sin and God using him at the very same moment. And you go, how does that work together? But lo and behold, that's Samson. All right, so chapter 13, verse 1, we're going to meet his folks, okay? Samson's parents. And just again, with that map color illustration in the back of your head, make some observations for me as we roll through Samson's life. Okay, 13:1, somebody pick up there.
Again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years.
Boy, I feel like we've heard that before. That's on repeat. Okay, so same story, like 19th verse. Okay, keep going.
Now there was a certain man from Zorah of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And
all right. Verse 2. So you're getting a picture of the condition of his pops. Okay, what do you notice about his dad? From Dan. From Dan, okay? Danites, okay? So we know one of the tribes of Israel. We've heard about Dan. Where's Dan located? You guys remember? Where's that? Not yet. Will be, okay? Correct, but kind of not, okay? They're on the west side over by the sea, okay? They're going to move north, and we're going to hit that story maybe today as to why that's the case, okay? So they are currently in the west. They're in the Shephelah. You guys remember our kind of terms for Israel? Far west side is the coastal plains. Next to the coastal plains are the low hills called the Shephelah. Dan's land is in the Shephelah. Zorah is in a valley in the Shephelah, okay? The Judah Mountains would have pushed, again, further to their east, and then finally, like, the Rift Valley, the Jordan Valley, kind of over there, all right? So Dan is kind of in this boomerang-shaped valley, and at the curve of the boomerang is Zorah, okay? Beth Shemesh is also there. You guys remember me talking about the four gateway cities into Jerusalem? Gezer, Beth Shemesh, Azekah, Lachish, from north to south. Beth Shemesh is one of those key cities that defends Jerusalem from the western border. Zorah is one of its neighbors. Okay, so they're in the Shephelah. Now, if you're living in the Shephelah, right, what does that mean in terms of the people around you? What is that piece of land, that area of land famous for? Where do the people of God normally live? Do you remember me talking about that? Yeah, more east in the Judah Mountains, okay? Where do the non-Christians live? In the west, on the coast. So what happens in the Shephelah? Battles, right? Not just physical battles, but what kind of battles? Spiritual battles. So you can very quickly learn about the spiritual temperature of the land based on who controls the Shephelah, okay? When God is winning the day and people are being obedient, it seems like the people of God kind of take that land, are obedient with it, and you see them occupying those places and putting down Dagon and all these other false gods. Okay, so we've got this guy Manoah who lives in this area, okay, in Zorah, in this kind of, again, boomerang-shaped area in the Shephelah. Okay, so this is his story. And what do you find out about his wife?
Barren.
Barren, right? We're going back to like Abraham days. This sounds familiar with the patriarchs and the wife of the patriarchs and the situation that God had painted. So we have this man and this woman who is barren, okay? Let's keep going in 3.
And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, indeed now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Now therefore, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink and not eat anything unclean. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite of God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the Philistines.
All right, so what do you find out about this guy? Verse 3, who shows up?
Angel
of the Lord. Like, it's a big deal, right? We don't see this all the time, and the angel of the Lord shows up to this woman, picks this gal sovereignly and says, you're barren, but you're going to have a son. And what is this son's ultimate role going to be? And he's going to deliver Israel. I have chosen him prior to birth to save Israel. He is going to be one of the judges that we're reading about. I will use him in a time of Israel's repentance to lead them out of sin and to defeat whatever conquering nation, which currently is the Philistines, that has you oppressed because of your bowing down to their gods and so forth. Okay? And then this woman, mother ultimately of Samson, is given some instructions. What do you notice about those in 4 and 5?
Don't drink and don't cut his hair.
Okay, don't drink, don't cut your hair. Elaborate on that in 5. What's behind that?
Nazarite.
Yeah, he's going to be a Nazarite. You guys remember the Nazarite vow? You remember where we came across that in our study thus far? Where was that? Do you remember? Close. Numbers, chapter 6. Turn there real quick, okay? What's that? Paul took a Nazarite vow. You've studied a couple characters in Scripture that have thus far. Paul took one. He concludes it in the book of Acts when he goes in with the other three guys, has to pay their vows. Probably cuts his hair. You guys see that mention of Paul and Acts 20-something? Anyway, probably the Nazarite vow. Number 6 is where we find that. Just for our sake, let's look at it because there's some tidbits that I just want to refresh our memories on this, right? This was kind of that above and beyond vow. Verse 2, Moses says, when a man or a woman takes a special vow, a plea was the Hebrew word. This idea is above and beyond. It's optional, but it's something that's pretty magnificent, okay? Notice all the things, just again, to refresh our memories as to what consisted of the Nazarite vow, which you could and couldn't do. Look up in verse 3, chapter 6, verse 3, and read that.
He shall separate himself from wine and similar drink.
Okay, so you can't have what? No wine and nothing from the grape. Okay, so this was, again, this was a normal part of Israel. Wine was a part of their culture, so you had to abstain from that. What else?
You shall drink neither vinegar made from wine nor vinegar made from similar drink.
Man, I had to wash the kitchen floors growing up with vinegar. Like, that was my punishment. That stuff is nasty. I don't know why people would put that in their mouth. I don't know why that would be, like, a regulation of the Nazarite vow. Dude, I got that one checked off. No problem. Never, ever an issue with me, okay? Keep going.
Neither shall he drink any grape juice nor eat fresh grapes or raisins.
Okay, grapes, no wine, what else? Verse 4.
All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine from seed to skin.
Okay, sorry, keep going to 5.
All the days of the vow of his separation no razor shall come upon his head until the days are fulfilled for which he has separated himself to the Lord.
Okay, so no haircut, right? And then in, where is it? Dead body. You can't touch anything dead. Where is that? Verse 7.
He shall not make himself unclean even for his father or for his mother, for his brother or his sister when they die because his separation to God is on his head.
All right, so you can't go mourn the dead? Man, I don't care if it's your father, mother, your brother, or sister. During your vow, you cannot make yourself unclean by the death of a family member, okay? So you're abstaining from natural things, okay? No strong drink, no wine, nothing from the grape, no haircut, no contact with dead people, okay? So just remember those in the back of your mind as we go now back to Samson, okay? So he is told from the beginning he's taking this optional vow, but it's going to be mandatory for Samson. So we've never seen this before, that it's been commanded by God, but that's the idea. So God says he's going to be separated. I'm going to use him. He's going to take this vow, and ultimately, he's going to deliver Israel, okay? So the angel of the Lord shows up to the mom, to the wife of Manoah, and then in verse 6, it says, the woman came and told her husband, a man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the angel of God, very awesome. I did not ask where he came from, nor did he tell me his name, but he said to me, verse 7, you're going to have a kid. He's going to take the Nazarite vow to the day of his death. Like, he's going to be separated to me, okay? Verse 8, keep reading. Let's learn a little bit about Manoah.
Then Manoah prayed to the Lord and said, oh, my Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come to see us again and teach us what we shall do for the child who will be born.
Okay, so what do you notice about Manoah? Make some observations about Samson's dad for me. What kind of family does Samson grow up in? Yeah, it's a godly home, right? He's got a godly dad. He's got apparently a godly mother as well. They're praying people. Man, she is overwhelmed by this. Goes and tells her husband. What does Manoah want to know? How do I raise this kid, God, in a way that would honor you? What does that tell you about where his heart is at this season in the flow of the book of Judges? More than likely, based on 13 verse 1, what is the condition spiritually of Israel right now? It's in the toilet, right? And how does Manoah feel about that? He's broken over it, right? But he's worshiping God. He's connected with God. He's not participating, it doesn't seem like, in idol worship. Like, he's hanging on to godliness in a very difficult day, Are these the kind of parents that you would love to have raise you, right? A godly mom and a godly dad that are concerned about the things of God, even when everybody else isn't? Dude, these are the model parents, right? Manoah and his wife are seeking God in a dark day, okay? So he says to her, man, let's hope this guy will come back. I want to know how we're supposed to raise this guy. Verse 8, he prays and says, God, show up and give me a little bit more, okay? Keep rolling in 9.
And the Lord listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came to the woman again as she was sitting in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. Then the woman ran in haste and told her husband and said to him, look, the man who came to me the other day has just now appeared to me.
All right, so the angel of the Lord shows back up to the woman again. She has to go grab her husband. Manoah comes in verse 11, followed his wife. And when he came to the man, he said to him, are you the man who spoke to the woman? And he said, I am, which cracks me up that that would be the answer, right? I am, right? There's so much hidden meaning in that, right? Manoah said now in verse 12, now when your words come to pass, what shall the boy's mode of life and his vocation be? What do you notice about Manoah's belief in this statement, by the way? His wife is still barren. They have never had a child. And this dude shows up and said, you're going to have a kid and he's going to save Israel. How does Manoah respond? Okay. All right, I totally believe you. Now, tell me more about how I'm supposed to rear this kid in a way that will honor you. What does he specifically ask?
What's his job?
Yeah, what's his job going to be? Where do you want me to steer him? Like, what direction do I need to push him in or encourage him in? So, great questions, right, for this dad to be asking. Like, how do I, from now till then, raise this kid in a way that will honor you? I mean, you see a rich faith in this family and a desire to honor God with their kid, right? And they see the conditions Israel's in, and they're wanting to get on the right side of that equation to help out, okay? 13, here's the angel's response.
So the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful. She may not eat anything that comes from the vine, nor may she drink wine of similar drink, nor eat anything unclean, and that all that I commanded her, let her observe.
So what does he reiterate? His vow that he's going to take, and what is, it doesn't just affect Samson, but who else? She's got to abstain, right? During pregnancy and what have you. Like, she's got to avoid these things, and they are great with that. So this is an inconvenience, if you will, a forced vow that she's going to take at least for the next 9 months while she has this kid in her womb. And Manoah says in verse 15, please let us detain you that we may prepare a young goat for you. Stay, have dinner. And the angel says, okay. Verse 16, here's his answer.
And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, though you detain me, I will not eat your food. But if you offer the burnt offering, you must offer it to the Lord. For Manoah did not know he was with the angel of the Lord.
Okay, or was the angel of the Lord is what my translation says. So it's fascinating to me that the angels never eat, right? Yeah, I'll hang out, but I'm not going to eat. But if you're going to offer an offering, offer it to God. And Manoah still hasn't figured out that this isn't just an angel, it's the angel. And in verse 17 now, you see this kind of fascinating back and forth about Manoah asking, who are you? Okay, 17, read that.
And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, what is your name that when your word comes to pass, we may honor you?
So, what's your name? So we can give you credit in the paper when, you know, this thing comes about. So he wants to honor him. Right heart. But he doesn't know who he's speaking with, right? Now, why would that be significant as we talk about, again, this naming deal? What are the implications behind naming?
Ownership,
right? So he says, man, I'm not even going to tell you my name. There's the answer here in verse 18. Read that.
The angel of the Lord said to him, why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful?
Same word, by the way, used for the Nazarite vow. A special vow, a plea vow. It's the same root word there for wonderful. My name is mind-blowing. I can't even tell you my name because it's wonderful. Would blow all your category. So why do you ask my name, seeing that it is wonderful, special? Verse 19, Manoah took the young goat, the grain offering, offered it on the rock to the Lord, and he performed wonders while Manoah and his wife looked on. So here is Manoah and his wife offering the offering that the angel of the Lord says, yeah, I'll stay. I won't eat, but great. Make dinner. offer this thing to the Lord, and he does. And what does the angel of the Lord do?
Performed wonders.
The heck is that? Performs wonders. So I'm not going to tell you my name, but I'll show you my name. I will demonstrate who I am before you, and they're going to get a very clear picture now that they didn't before of who this guest is that they are now entertaining. It's just not some random angels, if that wouldn't be mind-blowing enough. This is far beyond that. So they see something in this, in the actions behind this angel that are category-blowing. 20, pick up there.
It happened as the flame went up toward heaven from the altar. The angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. Then Manoah and his wife saw this, and they fell on their faces to the ground. And when the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and his wife, then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. And Manoah and his wife said to his wife, "We shall surely die because we have seen God."
So, pretty clear, like what happens there? Something occurs that is mind-blowing. The response is the typical response of everybody that sees God. And what do they say? We're going to die, right? We have seen holiness, and we're going to die in its presence, right? We are not that. They fall on their faces. They worship. You see this consistently throughout everyone who interacts with God, the angel of the Lord. And Manoah says this to his wife, "We're going to die." And it's her theology that it wins the day, thankfully. Verse 23.
But his wife said to him, "If the Lord had desired to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands, nor would he have shown us all these things, nor would he have told us such things as these at this time."
All right, so that's a wise woman. No, he'd have killed us. He's able. I think we figured that much out. We'd be dead by now. So she comforts him, and 24 now, watch what happens as the end of the story concludes.
So the woman bore a son and called his name Samson, and the child grew, and the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him at Manahe.
Good luck with that.
Dan, between Zorah and Esdraelon.
All right, so Samson is born, God blesses him. By the way, 24, underline that. The Lord blessed him. You're going to see that repeated over and over and over in the story of Samson. And there's times that it's going to be maddening. There's times it's going to seem completely inconsistent with the character of God, that Samson could be doing X while God is doing Y, and they are not congruent, and yet God is going to use both at the same time. It's a hard story sometimes to swallow theologically, if you will. But God is blessing this kid. So if you were to step back now and get out your map colors, talk to me about what you're coloring in 13.
Green.
What's green?
The fact that, yeah, his parents are godly.
Good night. Could you ask for better parents than this, right? This is amazing. So Samson's got godly parents. Dad's not passive. He's trying to lead. Mom is sensitive to the moving of the Holy Spirit. They clearly love each other. They're together. They're not worshiping some jacked up false god, Dagon, or what have you. So great. We got green all over that for their parents. What else do you see? Yeah, you see clearly at the end, like, man, this kid before birth has already been blessed by God. His plans have been put out from start to finish. God's hand is on him. That doesn't suck, right? That's wonderful. You're going to use me, God, to save the nation. And from prior to even coming out of the womb, guaranteed God's blessing. I mean, that's awesome. I'd like some of that. Give me a double portion of that. What else?
Basically, everything's stacked in his favor. So.
Totally, right? Is there any red? Is there any yellow? Not in mine, at least, right? I see a bookends of godliness, of a great start. I mean, if you want to start a kid off in life, right, this is the formula, yeah? Now, does godly parents automatically beget godly kids? No. I mean, I've seen some of the godliest parents I know that have raised some of the most jacked up kids that I know. And I've seen the opposite. Some of the most jacked up parents that produce, they don't produce it, obviously, but great, godly, God-fearing young men and women. And you look back at their past to go, how in the world are you not like just like like jacked in the head, much less godly, and like how are you not just completely screwed up and in a hole sucking your thumb and just like hiding from the world given your past? And yet God will use that as well. So we think perfect, like that's great sometimes. That means that these kids are going to be wonderful, okay? And we'll see how that ends up with Samson, okay? So in my Bible at least, man, there's a lot of green in this chapter. So we see a great start for this kid. Now, chapter 14, let's see what happens. So Spirit of God is moving in him. We're seeing in his hometown of Zorah something beginning to stir. And in 14 now, we're going to meet Samson when he's a little bit older, okay? We don't know exactly how old here, but he's through adolescence. He's probably past puberty, and let's see what's going on. 14:1. All right, pause there. Okay, make some observations. Where's Timnah?
Coastal.
Okay, who lives in Timnah? The Philistines. What's Samson doing? He's probably going to evangelize, right? He's going to go talk to all the people about Jesus over there, right? He's hanging out in the bars and, you know, telling them about Jesus. So he's in a questionable area, okay? We don't know what his intentions are, but he's in an area where I wouldn't say that he shouldn't be, but there's certainly, depending on his motives, this may not be the best idea, okay? My Bible, that's yellow. Like, what are you doing, Samson? Why are you there? Are you on a mission trip? Are you hanging out? Are you, like, what's going on, okay? And is this young man, it's interesting, okay? 14, he went down to Timnah, okay? Now, down, it would have been in some sense down in that they lived in the Judah Mountains. It was a descent down to the coast. And who does he see there? A woman, and what do you notice about her?
She's a Philistine.
So tell me about her background. Who does she worship?
Pagan gods,
right? So what happens as a result of sometimes being in the, even with maybe the best of intentions, the wrong place at the wrong time, when you're putting yourself in compromising situations? Samson meets someone that maybe isn't the best for him, right? He's fishing out of the wrong pond, if you will. And we're going to find out what his intentions are here pretty quickly. Okay, so you see some indicators of something that's going on within Samson. This is surface level, and we're going to begin to figure out where that root is with him, right? What's going on in him that would cause him to be here, okay? Verse 2.
Then he came up and told his father and mother, "I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife."
Whoa, E-break, what the heck? He comes back, and what happens?
He's spoiled.
Dude, I mean, you talk about a kid that has a silver spoon in his mouth. How does he speak to his parents, first of all?
Go get me this.
My goodness. Disrespectful. You do this for me. Why do you think that is?
He got grades.
He got what?
I would almost think like after everything that happened with the angel, it was kind of like they raised him in a sense where it was almost a little too lenient.
Potentially, yeah, absolutely. Cass, what are you going to say?
I was just saying he was like their only child and a gift. So.
Yeah. Do you think you tell a kid growing up enough times, you're special, God's going to use you, you're amazing? You think that went to his head a little bit? Do you think he realizes, dude, I am untouchable. God has guaranteed to use me to deliver the nation from that? Went to his head. So he's like, I can do whatever the heck I want to, right? There wasn't a humility about that. He doesn't have the same heart as mom and dad to recognize the blessing behind that. He's had an inheritance gained too quickly. He is a spoiled child and does not realize the value of what he has and the weight of responsibility that comes with that. Now, what he doesn't realize is how God is going to use him. He's going to be used, right? No doubt. And he will deliver Israel. Everything that God said is true. But I think partly because of his handling of said gifts and privileges that come with that, he's going to get used in a way that he doesn't expect. What do you think Samson thinks when he thinks God's going to use me? Yeah, man, I'm some guy. I'm gonna be important. I'm gonna be a bigwig. I'll be like some of these other judges that surely he's heard the story of, right? Can you imagine them sitting around and mom and dad are telling them about Tola and Jephthah and Gideon and the little bits of godliness, those small little flames in the land that led to repentance of the people in the midst of darkness. Like, Samson's probably hearing this. So you're getting a very quick overview of where this led him. So this went to me from in 14 yellow, man, to red. He is disrespectful. He is ungrateful. He is spoiled. And in two verses, you can see that. Okay. Now tell me about Samson's sin patterns. What are his itches, if you will? What do you see immediately in his life? Dude, he's got a women problem, right? He's got a lust problem. He has ultimately, however you want to paint it, he has a flesh problem, right? I want this. Pick whatever issue it is. For Samson, it's a woman or women, as we're going to see as we roll through this. He's got a flesh problem. And when he's battling between the flesh and the spirit, who wins in Samson's life? Flesh. All the time. So you're seeing a root level issue that's now coming to the surface with Samson in the form of, I want this, I will have this, go get her for me. So he speaks to his parents in this kind of condescending, very disrespectful way. Does Samson know who this woman is? Does he know enough about her to know what type of woman she is? Yeah, she's from Philistine, from the land of Philistia. She's a Philistine. More than likely, we're to assume that she worships the gods of the Philistines. Should something be clicking in his head like, this is not what God wants for me? This is not God's best? It should, and you got to think that he knows the stories. And in fact, in verse 3, his mom and dad are going to say, hey, dude, pump the brakes a little bit. Like, hold on. Let's talk about this. Verse 3. So what are mom and dad saying?
Maybe she's not right for you.
Yeah, this may not be a good idea. By the way, how do they phrase that? I love this about his parents. You get the impression that Samson's older, probably a teenager. He's not 5 where you say, you're grounded, you're getting a whooping or a spanking or whatever, you know, go sit in time out. He's older, right? So what do his parents say?
Are the people in your church better?
What's that?
Aren't the people in your church good
enough? Yeah. Yeah.
They make the choice for him.
They ask the question and say, Samson. So you hear, you know what they think about this woman, but they ask the question and pose it to him. Samson, I don't think this is a good idea. But they don't say, I don't think this is a good idea. But they clearly say with their question, maybe not the best idea. Okay? So they put it out there. So is this really what you want to do? And you see the details. These uncircumcised Philistines. So you get the idea that this is clearly a very subtle rebuke in Samson's life. Okay, this is his authority. This is his community. When the people around him say, hey, man, think about this. Pause for a second and think about what you're doing. How does Samson respond to authority? How does he respond to reproof in his life? See also rest of verse 3.
But Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she's right in my eyes.
Wow. How do you see him respond to godly wisdom in his life? I don't care. This is what I want, and I'm going to have it. Boy, is that not telling? I mean, we're 3 verses in to Samson's story out of the womb, and what are you seeing about this guy already? We have a saying in Texas called too big for your britches. That's Samson. He thinks a lot of himself. He thinks he's invincible, right? So I can't die. God's going to use me. It doesn't really matter what decisions I make because my life's going to end up on that path regardless. And in some sense, he's right. God is going to use him and is going to bless him. But it's clearly gone to his head. Yeah, Andres.
So the advice that his parents are giving him, is that, would you call that like godly wisdom or is just wisdom in general?
I think it's both. Is there no woman from among the daughters of your people or your relatives? Is that what God wants? What did he say when the people got into the land? don't intermarry. So what's Samson trying to do? Intermarry. So you see this godliness in his parents saying, dude, pick a tribe. Man, we got 13 of them. Anyone would be fine. And I think maybe even Dan, as we find out somewhere in here, talks about both his mom and his dad are both Danites. They married within the tribe, which is even a sense of they're hanging on to the Levitical law and those sorts of things. So they marry within, and they're wanting the same for his son or their son, right? So if you were to put a map color on verse 3, how would you label that? What character qualities do you see in Samson that give you pause? Repulsive, okay. Impulsive, not repulsive, sorry. Impulsive is a great one. What else? He probably isn't repulsive, by the way.
I would do, his parents' stuff would be in green, and then his response would be red.
Okay. What specifics? Like, what do you write next to your red flag? Rebellious. Self-centered, for sure. Man, I think the way someone responds to reproof in their life says a lot about them. Think about that in your life, right? As you guys desire things and you're vulnerable enough to open up your life to other people and say, man, speak into this for me. And other people say, Mike, I don't know. I don't see that. Or I don't think that's a good idea. Or Mike, that's sin. Like, that is not okay. You should not do that. How do I respond? How do you respond? That says a lot about who you are. And we're seeing those character qualities in Samson where, man, he's above that. These people are beneath him. He doesn't get reproved. He doesn't get rebuked. He gets what he wants because he's Samson. So you're seeing qualities in this guy that you don't like. Ladies, by the way, these are, how do I say it? If you see this in guys that you are in pursuit with towards marriage, kick them to the curb, not now, yesterday. If a guy's not teachable, is not moldable, cannot handle other people speaking into his life, you are going to have a jacked marriage because he's going to be right 100% of the time. You're going to be wrong, and there's nobody that's going to tell him otherwise. You do not want that in a spouse. You'd be much better off having a spouse that's jacked but teachable and can learn and humble themselves underneath the hand of God and godly people around them than a guy that thinks he's got it all together and nobody's going to tell him otherwise. That is not a good sign, okay? Now, to everyone around him, how does Samson look? More than likely, he's a golden child. He looks good. He literally looks good. This guy is Fabio in every sense of the word. You talk about walking in a room and every woman went, son, does he have a brother too, right? That's Samson, right? He is impressive. We'll see, because he sees a woman and says, get her. I want her. And I already know she wants me because I'm Samson. That's his attitude with life, okay? So, verse 4. Figure this one out.
His father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines.
What? He did not know that this was from the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. God wants Samson to marry a Philistine woman who does not worship God, so that he can defeat the Philistines. What? He just said, don't intermarry, like 19 times when they came into the land, to not do this. And what is God saying? How do you reconcile that?
He's in control.
Samson would probably do it anyway. Darn right he would. Here's how I reconcile this, okay? I would make the case, based on what we have clearly said in Scripture, this is sin for Samson, yes? To marry a known pagan woman, his parents even step in and say, this is a bad idea. Like, if this was a God-honoring woman that was a Philistine, what do you think his parents would have said? At least said, not no, maybe they would rather him marry within. But you kind of get the idea with this godly heritage that his parents have, that they can sniff out godliness in others. She doesn't have this. So they said, look, I don't care that she's a Philistine, but boy, she worships Dagon, or clearly doesn't worship our God. This is not a good idea. So had Had this been a godly woman, I think his parents would have given him maybe a green light. But you don't see that. There's a clear rebuke. So I would say, based on what we see in Scripture and what God has said, this is sin. Can God use his sin for his glory? Can he accomplish his purpose even in the midst of human disobedience? Yes, and I think that's what's happening here. I think Samson's in sin, and God's saying, listen, my will is big enough that I can use that to accomplish my purpose. And Samson, you're a part of that equation. Now, would I rather accomplish that a different way? Is there a better way? Yeah. There's a less painful way. There's a way that you don't die in the end, Samson, with your own pride and humiliation at stake. There's a different way. But if you want to walk down that path, God says, okay, I will take my hands off the steering wheel, and I will allow you to go down that road. I know where it's going to end. This is not what you want. So that is how I see those together. That is a very difficult wording. And again, you see this with Samson. In the midst of his sin, God says, I'm using this. Okay, and it's strong language. So y'all reconcile that. That's how it makes sense in my head. God is indeed seeking an occasion, and this is the means that he's going to use to defeat the Philistines. Okay, because at the end of verse 4, at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel. They have lost control of the Shephelah. The spiritual temperature of the land is on dim. Dagon is being exalted. Syncretism is happening. That's the condition. Okay, so verse 5, let's keep going.
And Samson went down with his father and mother to Timnah, and they came to the vineyards of Timnah, and behold, a young lion came toward him roaring. Then the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and although he had nothing in his hand, he tore the lion in pieces as one tears a young goat. And he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. And he went down and talked to the woman, and she was right in Samson's eyes.
Okay, stop right there. There's a whole lot going on here. Okay, verse 5. Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother. They come upon vineyards, and there's a lion in the land, okay? So in that day and age, lions, we're going to see with David, bears, and oh my, we're all there. Tigers as well, apparently. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. We're all in this area of land. Samson sees a lion, and what does he do? He rips it apart. Why? Because he can. That's Samson. So to put his strength on display, okay, again, I don't know if it's a red flag, but certainly yellow. What is he doing?
Showing off.
He's kind of showing off, right? This is some, 18, 19, 20-year-old kid. I don't know. It's just like, yeah, I can. Watch this. So he does.
It's just interesting to me because it says his parents are with him, but then he tears the lion apart and he didn't tell his parents.
Yeah, so apparently they go down together. There's a separation that happens at some point. Samson comes across this lion. Maybe you can make the argument it's in self-defense. Who knows? But he comes across this lion and tears it apart. Now, stepping back from that regardless, that's freaking impressive, right? Samson versus lion. Who wins that every time, like normally, if it's not Samson? The lion, right? Duh. But Samson, this is impressive. So this guy is clearly, he's fast, he's strong, ridiculously strong, and, yeah, able to do this. Yeah, Max.
Is he breaking his vow by killing a lion?
Great question. Let's talk about that.
Well, I'm just looking at how it says the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, like rushed upon him. I mean, just kind of looking at it in that sense, is it the Lord wanting him to do that instead of him just showing off?
Yep. Potentially. Yeah, Stephen. Potentially, and maybe we can give him a pass here, okay? So let's assume the best, and it's self-defense, okay? So he's about to get eaten. He defends himself against the lion. Okay, we all at least would have attempted to defend ourselves before we got eaten. Samson, on the other hand, beats the lion, okay? The Spirit of the Lord comes upon him mightily, so maybe this isn't sin, if you will. I think that's a very valid interpretation at this point to give him a little bit of, wiggle room in this, okay? Why does he not tell his father and mother? What would killing the lion have done for Samson under the Nazarite vow? Broken the vow, right? He's just been in contact with death. You cannot touch anything dead. So why would you not tell the parents? dude. That's inconvenient. That's a pain. I don't want to confess. I don't want to repent. I don't want to have to go down that road. That's a freaking whip. So no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to tell my mom and dad. Is there anyone around that saw my sin? No? Okay, moving on. No big deal, right? So he kind of, again, that's where it's hard. Is it sin? Is it not? Whatever. Regardless, he looks at his uncleanliness. He's like, it's not that big a deal. I'm Samson. It's not that important. So he glosses over it, okay? So he doesn't want to tell his parents. He would have had to restart the vow, which wouldn't have been the end of the world. But now he's got to cut his hair to start the vow over, right? Which brings him what? Shame, embarrassment, right? Everybody knows, oh, dude, you blew it. You've got these long locks of hair. You've been growing them since you were how long? And everybody knows you did something to break your vow, right? So there's a sense of pride that you see in Samson that he's not willing to let go of to confess and be humble. He won't do it. Now, let's give him a pass on this go-around with the lion, okay? Now, verse 7, let's keep rolling. Okay, what do you notice about 7? My translation says, he talked to the woman, and she looked good to Samson. I mean, that is as clear as what his motivations are as anything else, okay? You get 5 words on who she is, and who is she? Hot, okay? That's what she is. She is a trophy wife. Nothing about her character, nothing about her insides. Samson sees her and says, yes, I'll have that. Thank you very much. That's all we know about her. Okay, she is apparently attractive in Samson's eyes. So what are you seeing in Samson? What are his motivations as we've talked about his maybe root issues?
Flesh.
His flesh is just dominating him, right? What he sees, he wants. Where does the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the boastful pride of life? She saw that the apple was good for food and for knowledge. Does this sound familiar to you? So she took of it and she ate. She saw, she desired, she took, she ate. He saw, he desired, he took, and he is going to do what husbands do, right? That's Samson, man. He is driven 100% by his flesh, okay? So now he gets this woman. Verse 8 now, let's go to part 2 with said lion. All right, so what's going on in 8?
He clearly broke the vow.
Okay, talk to me about it, Adolf.
Because he knows he's not supposed to touch the dead, yet he clearly goes in ignoring that and then indulging in it.
Yep.
And sharing it.
Yep.
With his parents.
So he's clearly now put his hands inside the carcass of a dead lion, right? He's broken the vow. Let's back up a step and ask this. Why is he there? Does he know where the carcass of the dead lion is? Mm-hmm. Pretty easily avoidable. He knows where it died. He knows where he killed it, right? Why is he there?
He's on the same path to the girl.
He wants to see what he did.
This is my trophy, and I'm going to go look at it. You guys ever heard the story about, like, arsonists when they burn stuff? They always come back, and they always watch the fire. They're always in the crowd watching what they did. That's Samson. This is my prize. This is what I have done, and he wants to go look at it again. He wants to go see it, and he won't avoid the area. Could he have? Absolutely. Could he have confessed and said, man, this is what happened, Mom and Dad. I blew it. It was an accident. It was in self-defense. I'm unclean. Yeah, right? Now, where is this leading him? You see the progression of this, the road that it's leading him on? What is he thinking about this? It's not a big deal. I can handle it. This is a 1, 2, 3, right? It's not that big a deal. Now where is it progressing to? It's quickly getting out of control. His flesh is running rampant, and he can't control it. He turns aside. He looks at the carcass of the lion, and oddly enough, like, what do we notice about? What should we see in the carcass of a lion? Days later. Filth, death, decay, nastiness, right? You don't stick your hands in there. Like, we've all seen Bear Grylls. That ain't right, okay? You don't, it's filthy, okay? If you haven't seen Bear Grylls, you need to watch it. It's so good. He's one of the five people that I would have at my dinner table, by the way, right? You ever play the game? Like, who are the five people you'd sit down and talk with? Dude, I'd have him over for dinner tomorrow. He's a good dude. He scrapes, just so you guys know, okay? So if you run into him, let him know Mike wants to eat dinner with you, okay? I don't know, but he's on the list, so definitely Bear Grylls. Without my wife there, because he's actually a really good-looking dude, too, which would be, that would be awesome. So, I don't know. That would just intimidate me. All right, so we find out within the carcass of the lion is what? A beehive and honey and something to eat. So he puts his hand in it. What's that about? Where does that come from?
How would he even scrape the honey out? Is honey in like honeycombs? Like, don't you have to drain it?
It's on the hive, yeah. So apparently it's there and accessible. So y'all figure that out, you biologist. I'm not one. I don't know. But he eats of it, right? It's sweet. It, you know, on a, you know, you see this throughout stories with David and Jonathan, that this would have been normal to find hives of bees and honey, and it, you know, it's a sugar rush, right? We all know what that does when you pound a Snickers bar, and you're like, woohoo, and then, right? But that's what it does for you. It temporarily lifts up your, you know, your spirits or what have you because of the sugar, and he eats, and then he gives some to his parents. So now they're kind of participating in his sin without knowing it. So you just, you see these things with him that are just, man, they're questionable. They're, what are you doing, Samson? And then in the midst of that, you also see this issue with the girl, with, you know, his pride. There's just so many layers to this guy in terms of what's going on, okay? Now, regardless of take one, take two, this is clearly sin. He knows better. He's clearly broken his vow. He's living in disobedience. What happens, by the way, when you approach the altar of God knowing that you're unclean? According to the book of Leviticus, you die. Because it's offensive. It's saying that my sin doesn't matter, that God can just overlook it. It's not a big deal. You know, God provided a way to overlook it so that it wouldn't be a big deal, but there was a process and there was a procedure. And Samson was unwilling to humble himself to that process, to take on the physical embarrassment that would have been, the shame that maybe would have brought him, or just at least in his own eyes what he thought, and he won't do it. So that's where we're at. Now,
would you say that this is a clear test, though, just given the location of the bees and honey? Because that seems like a very odd location to be in the carcass.
Totally. I mean, there's clearly something supernatural about that, right? That's God's hands behind how this honey got in there to begin with. So, yeah, is it a test? Yeah, I'd say so. It's unnatural, so it has to be from the Lord to some way. And yet, how's he do? He fails, right? Let's keep going and see how he does. Verse 10. All right, so we're having his bachelor party, okay? The pre-wedding festivities, okay?
And Samson said to them, "Let me now put a riddle to you. If you can tell me what it is within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes."
That's a huge offer. I mean, that's basically him saying, "I will provide a new wardrobe for all 30 of you." Okay, it's a pretty significant deal, all right? Verse 3 now. Keep going. All right, now we know what this riddle is. What is Samson referring to? The lion and the honey, right? We know the story that just occurred. Now, what is Samson doing now with this sin issue in his life? He's boasting in it, right? Not only is he not repentant and not turning back to the Lord, but he's bragging about his sin, right? This is a guy that's talking about his ungodliness in a way that he's boasting and proud of. Like, you're seeing, again, these continual issues with Samson that are popping up in this pride and this these character level issues. Okay, now 15, we see in verse 11 he has 30 companions to be with him. We're about to figure out or see who these companions are, his groomsmen, if you will, in his wedding. These are the type of men that Samson has around him. 15.
Invited us here to impoverish us, and Samson's wife wept over him.
Oh, what? these guys are mad that they have to pay up at the end of a bet. And what is their solution to this problem? They threaten her with what? I will not just death. I will set you on fire, you and your household. Now tell us the answer to the riddle. Like, golly. Talk to me about the quality of men that Samson has in his life. They're jacked, right? These are not friends. These are the opposite of friends, right? These are your boys that run with you, right? When everything's good and you're in sin, and when you try to turn your life around, they mock you or what have you. These are jacked guys.
Why is that always the first response? Like, I'll set you on fire. Like, I'm going to punch you in the face. Nah, let me just set you on fire first.
I don't know. Guys in fire.
But it's just like, let me just light you on fire.
Y'all figure that one out. I have no idea. But, again, just bad... bad companions, bad counsel. He's surrounding himself with the wrong people. And potentially, these guys have to be brought to him because he doesn't have anybody in his life. He doesn't have accountability. He doesn't have true friends. He doesn't have anybody that he shares life with at any kind of deeper level. Because he's Samson. What does he need that for? He's untouchable, right? I don't need that. 16, Samson's wife wept before him. This is fascinating. So they're to be married. And this is Samson's wife's response underneath the the conundrum that she's in.
You only hate me, you do not love me. You have put a riddle to my people, and you have not told me.
Okay, I'm sorry, Cass. You have to read that like this. You only hate me, you don't love me. Oh, Samson. Right, this is a whiny, dripping faucet of a woman. She's just... this is the Proverbs dripping faucet. He is being whipped by her in order for her to get what she wants. She's manipulating. Now, I don't blame the gal, right? She's just been threatened. She's been given a death threat. I'd want the answer too, and I would do whatever it took to save me and my family as well. But you're seeing the quality of their marriage or marriage to be, yes? This is not good, okay? Yes, she's hot, but this is what you get underneath the surface, right? Not good, okay? He said to her, behold, I have not told it to my father or my mother. Should I tell it to you? Like, I haven't even told my mom and dad the answer to this riddle. Why would I tell it to you, woman? Now, that's a whole other jack theology of marriage. Who should he be telling it to? His wife is one flesh. You leave and cleave, Genesis 2:24. So, like, God, nothing about this is godly or good or even a hint of how a godly marriage ought to be. Okay? Now, 17, it keeps going. She ramps up the dripping. 7 days. Samson. Awful. Okay, keep going.
And on the seventh day, he told her because she pressed him hard.
You whipped me so long and would not, that's the idea. She is working him. And finally, he breaks down and told the riddle to the sons of her people. So he finally says, man, this is it. I'm tired of you barking, right? 18, keep going. Okay, hold on. So they get the answer to the riddle from the wife, okay, and then Samson's response, this is, guys, don't ever, ever do this. Wow. So he's calling his wife a fat cow. Had you not plowed with my heifer, you would not know the riddle. Now, I think in that he's like, you took what was mine and used it for your own good. He uses a really stupid example. Like, buddy, you were so on the couch tonight. Like, that is dumb. So don't ever do that, right? Solomon compares his wife to a goat, and it apparently is godly, right? Talks about her teeth all having pears and what have you. So, but goats are good. Don't compare it to a cow, apparently. So anyhow, so that's, he finally breaks down, tells her the riddle. She tells the people, companions come back to Samson, and they say, okay, here's the riddle. Now, verse 19, here's another paradox. So in 19, what happens?
He gets a divorce.
What's that?
He gets a divorce.
Not exactly. That's 20, but let's stay on 19 for a second.
He kills 30 guys for clothing.
He beats 30 guys down, strips them naked, takes their clothes, gives them to the companions because he lost the bet and he's paying up on it.
But wait, first the Spirit of the Lord rushes
upon him. Who the heck is behind this whole deal? God! God is blessing this guy, right? Like, how do you make the argument that this is not sin? Samson's killing. He's murdering 30 innocent people. Like, he has no reason to do this other than his own pride, but the enabling comes from the Spirit of God on him. How does God reconcile that? Jeff, I
wonder. Philistines, though, right?
They are. They are, certainly.
God just really doesn't like the Philistines.
Is it almost like an allowance type thing? Like, it's obviously his strength comes from work, so it's kind of like a gift that is. It's just stating that. It's not that he's doing out of disobedience to God that he's so strong, more or less that God's allowing it.
Yeah.
So it's not the decisions made by God, but the decisions kind of, for whatever reason, this power is, like, given by God.
Certainly possible, yeah. Stephen?
Yeah, so you talked about the Spirit of the Lord rushing upon him. Are we reading into it that he's got this, like, supernatural strain, or...
Yeah, we see that same phrase in 6 when he defeats the lion. Like, so there is some type of supernatural enabling that happens with Samson that is clearly rooted in God that enables him to perform a task that is beyond his ability. So that's how I see it. Now, I don't take it so far as to say that God is pleased or participating in sin with Samson. That cannot be. But clearly the strength is not his own. We see that pattern, that there are moments where he has this supernatural strength that maybe he doesn't have all the time, and then goes from there. Yeah, Will.
Well, my thought is we're looking at it as a sin perspective from our world set where God has put in, hey, do not murder, do not do this. But in all reality, we're all instruments and tools of God's divine will to bring about his glorification. And, I mean, through Scripture, you go through... killing the firstborn in Egypt all the way to, I mean, he opens up the world to swallow up a bunch of the Israelites in the middle of the desert.
Mm-hmm.
God's will has been, you know, sacking entire cities and wiping out their entire civilization. And originally, like, the orders to Joshua was to go wipe everyone out in the land, and they didn't do that.
Yeah.
And so, not necessarily, like, we're looking at it as kind of like on our end of our kind of perspective view is God participating in sin, or is God's will that these people are just not his...
Yeah, I hear you. God's certainly done that. And I don't know that God wanted everyone in the land killed. He wanted them removed. Now, battle's battle, and that's going to happen, but I don't know that it was hard to annihilate everybody. And he's going to call out specific tribes where he will annihilate the Amalekites, for instance, because of their sin that's still forthcoming. But, I mean, I have a hard time reconciling that with something that God desired. It just seems there's no higher purpose to that. There's no... In some of these, at least you can make the argument that's God's land. I don't know. I mean, it's just difficult. And I don't want to excuse one and then not excuse another. It's just difficult. Do you see why you always just paint Samson in some godly light? It just makes it easier, right? It's, oh, no. He's the flannel graph Samson. It's all good. You know, this was all God's will. It's much easier to categorize that way. But that's not who he is. That's just not Samson. He is a rebellious, hard, self-focused, fleshly dude that God says, you know what, I'm going to use you too. Like, and I think in some ways it's very encouraging to a selfish, hard, self-focused, fleshly dude that God uses anyway, right? So his story in some sense is like, God, you can still use me despite my own closet full of junk that I wish I didn't struggle with. And yet I do. And you're still going to use me for your glory. Not because I'm great, because I'm not, but because of my own issues and you taking, you know, you can do whatever you want through whomever. So.
Kind of present an idea that I think. So I'm thinking that,
seems like throughout this whole thing, it's like the Spirit of the Lord, like, overseeding, or whatever that word is, like the letter of the law, you know. So like he has this Nazarite vow, which is very much like a picture of the letter of the law, you know, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And at every point it seems like the Spirit of the Lord is like saying, no, like my ways and my leading by the Spirit is above that, you know. Like I'm thinking of, like, fast forward to the New Testament where like Jesus is touching like lepers and unclean people. You know, where like, according to the law, that would be very unclean.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so at every point, it's like, well, he marries this woman. That's definitely not according to the law, but the Spirit leads him into it. He touches this this carcass, or he kills this lion, but the Spirit leads him into it. He's like stealing from people and killing people, but the Spirit leads him into it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's like,
I'm with you. That makes some sense. According to the New Testament, what did Jesus come to do regarding the law? To fulfill it, not abolish it. So Jesus obeyed the entire Old Testament law. Now, in regards to the cleanliness stuff, absolutely, right? And he broke Sabbath. He broke certain to show that there is a higher law, but it wasn't necessarily in violation of those things. He's saying, I'm a fulfillment of these things. So God can't contradict himself. It can't be sin, and then God saying, I'm going to bless that. There's a tension there that we still have to hold in balance. I like where you're going with that, but that it's just a difficult tension. Jesus fulfilled the law. He walked with God in every way. So there is a piece that has to still fit here. So, and I don't know, frankly, how it all fits together. I don't know how God can ordain that, be over that, and in some sense even be in control of that, and will it to be so, and yet it still be Samson's responsibility for his actions. And
kind of reminds me of like the Job cult thing with Job, where it's more or less that yes, God does have the ultimate power. He's letting kind of Samson make his desires, which Samson's obviously just going into
mm-hmm.
deeper and deeper, and God's just kind of allowing it. And yes, obviously his power is through Samson working towards kind of Samson's desires, which is getting closer to God's desires. So it's like you said, one of those things where Samson's desires aren't necessarily God's desires in the short term, but it's leading towards in the long term.
Okay.
So it kind of reminds me of the same thing. I don't know if it is comparison.
Right.
Where, yes, did God have the ultimate authority to stop any time? Yes, he could have stopped it. But the long term, God kind of knew the ending.
Right. Okay. Eric?
Yeah, I kind of maybe fall in line with some of these guys too, of just, you know, there's that prophet that's like, God, your people are wicked all the time. When are you going to punish them? He's like, oh, I am. I'm raising up this evil nation that's going to come and destroy you guys because that's my judgment. And
mm-hmm.
he's like, what? You can't have this group that doesn't look good on you. And he's
mm-hmm.
like, oh, no. They'll get theirs too. Like, there'll be that punishment.
Right.
You know? So, like, they're that nation was still, like, responsible for their actions.
Totally.
But there's still, like, the thing. And then, you know, even in, what was it, 13?
Yeah.
When this began, he said, like, hey, this kid's going to deliver you from the Philistines.
Mm-hmm.
This is a jacked way of that.
Yeah.
Happening,
he's a lot like a pagan nation that God's using despite himself. So, how about, you're seeing some pneumatology here, by the way. How does the Spirit of the Lord work, Old Testament? Comes and goes. Comes and goes. Enables, but doesn't seal. Now, paint this issue in a New Testament context. The Spirit of God that dwells in us, that doesn't come and go, it comes and seals and stays forever, right? Once we profess the name of Christ, we're sealed with that Spirit, okay? That's biblical solid theology, okay? There's no second helping of it. There's no second blessing that comes with it. There's no speaking tongues and what have you. Like, Shay's probably beat this horse good and dead, hopefully. So does the Spirit in some sense enable us to do things that are not honoring to the Spirit? I have the Spirit in me. Pretty sure. You guys may not be. I'm pretty sure. Do I still sin? Yes. I'm absolutely sure of that. So in some sense, you look at that and go, well, can the Spirit of God participate in my sin? Well, yeah, the Spirit's in me. Is that what the Spirit desires? Clearly no, but I do anyway, right? So this isn't incongruent with even New Testament theology. But again, that's the wrestling with Samson. How do you put those two together? So I like that you guys are getting to the bigger view. Can God use evil things for his good? Absolutely, and he does. And we see a book full of stuff with that, 66 of them, in fact, where God demonstrates that he can do whatever he wants with whomever he wants, okay? And yet he is not, he's not culpable for that. He's not responsible. He's not forcing us. We're not robots, and yet we see that tension, okay? So, jacked up friends in the spirit of God doing all these crazy things. 20, Samson's wife was given to his companion who had been his friend. Cass, I think you said best man. How jacked is that? They're at the wedding, and they hand the bride-to-be to the best man and say, go marry her, like, or him, rather. That's bizarre. So, again, the quality of his friends, not so good. So, 15 now. Let's pick up on here, and let's see kind of how the rest of the story plays out.
After some days of the time of wheat harvest, Samson went to visit his wife with a young goat, and he said, I will go into my wife in the chamber, but her father would not allow him to go in.
Wow. So his wife is now married to another dude, his best man in his wedding, and what does Samson say? What does that mean, verse 1? Oh, he knows. What is he saying? Anna, you're shaking your head.
Yeah.
I'm going to go have sex with her right now. I mean, do you see how driven he is by his flesh? I don't care that she's married to another dude. That's my wife. Wow. And her father has to step in and say, whoa, E-break, calm down. I really, verse 2, thought that you hated her intensely because that was the nature of your relationship. So I gave her to your companion. And he doesn't know what to do. And he's thinking, man, I just got to get his eyes off of her. Is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? She's double hot. And Samson, that's clearly all you care about is her look. So have her instead. Please let her be yours instead. What a horrible position for a dad to be in. Like, this guy is so dogmatic on having his will fulfilled and his flesh appeased that's Samson's, that's his heart. So verse 3, keep going.
And Samson said to them, this time I shall be innocent in regard to the Philistines when I do them harm.
Interpret that for me. What is Samson saying? What's happened to him?
He says he thinks he's been wronged.
He's been wronged?
He gets to do whatever he wants to the Philistines and he'll be innocent.
Okay, take that a step deeper. He's been wronged. Okay.
You can't do that to Samson.
You can't do that to me, right? That's his pride you're jacking with. You've made me look bad. Again, you see the forces that drive this guy. He refuses to be humbled. So I'll bow up again, and this is what he does. And this is insane what he's able to do.
Samson went and caught 300 foxes.
Now, stop. What? Have you guys ever seen a fox? Have you ever tried to chase a dog that doesn't want to come inside? I got an 8-pound rug that runs around and I can't catch my little dog, right? When he wants to be outside and running the street, he's outside running the street. I can't catch him, and he's a little mutt, right? Much less a fox, much less 300 of them. He catches by hand. So not only is he wicked strong, he's wicked fast, right? And can catch foxes. Keep going, Haleen, 4. Yeah, you figure that one out. So he catches the foxes, right? Ties their tails together, puts a torch in between them. I don't know where he came up with this idea. This is odd, but it apparently is very effective. Ties their tails together, puts a torch between their tails, and then it's going to send them into the Philistine city, okay? Verse 5, when he had set fire to the torches, he released the foxes in the standing grain of the Philistines, burning up the whole, both the shocks and the standing grain, along with the vineyards and the groves. So he just completely destroys their harvest. You guys remember what the Amalekites had done to the Israel, or the Midianites, rather? They came in, and instead of going to battle with them, they just burned everything. Said, enjoy breakfast. Oh, you don't have any. We just burned it all. See ya. That's what they're doing. Samson just sets everything on fire. Dirty. Okay? 6, keep going.
Then the Philistines said, who has done this? And they said, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion.
So, again, this little thing that he thought was a little baby cub that he could protect and handle, and it's just a small little thing, it's just a 1, 2, or 3, is quickly growing outside of Samson's ability to contain. And that's the illusion of sin. It seems so small, and it is ultimately going to destroy Samson. So the Philistines do what?
Came up and burned her and her father with fire.
Wow. You want to play that game, Samson? We'll one-up you. We'll set her and her father's house on fire. Now what are we seeing as the result of Samson's sin? We haven't seen this yet. Hold on real quick, Haley. What's going on specifically? What is Samson's sin doing to those around him? We're having, there are consequences. She's done nothing wrong, per se. Her dad certainly hasn't. The house that just got burned down, these are his consequences. His poor decisions being now affected upon others. Now keep going, Haley. Right. Sure you will, Samson, because clearly you have the ability to deny your flesh and not keep going. So, but do you see the lie that he's selling himself in regard to his own issues? I can stop whenever I want to. How many addicts have you heard that out of, right? I'm fine. So he refuses to be humbled. He cannot be one-upped. He has to maintain his pride. So he struck them ruthlessly with a great slaughter. He went down and lived in the cleft of a rock at Etham. So he beats down and kills all these guys that set fire to the house. These guys were all the men standing at his wedding, like last week, and he kills all of them. The Philistines went up and camped at Judah. They spread out at Lehi. Verse 10 now, they're coming to exact their revenge on him. Pick up there. Watch this. One guy, and this is how many dudes they send.
Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Edom and said to Samson, "Do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What then is this that you have done to us?" And he said to them, "As they did to me, so I have done to them."
So again, packed with meaning here, but the Philistines and the men of Judah come together. The men of Judah now go to get Samson on behalf of the Philistines, and they send 3,000 dudes to get Samson. And they realize that's probably not even enough, right? So they're trying to talk him down. What is this that you have done? These guys are rulers over us. They are our oppressors at this time. So they're honest about the condition. And Samson's response is, "As they did to me, so I have done to them." Doesn't that sound like an 8-year-old's response? Well, she hit me first, so I just, right? That's someone that has no self-control, no ability to withhold their actions. It sounds like a very childish response to sin, and that's exactly what he is. He's a child in a grown-up's body. Keep going in 12. Yeah, we're all going to die, Samson, unless you surrender. So they said to him, "No, we're not going to kill you. We're going to bind you fast, give you into their hands, yet we will not kill you." They bound him with 2 new ropes, and they brought him up from the rock. So he's hiding in these caves in the Shephelah. He's delivered now under his own will to the Philistines. Okay, 14. Okay, so God now is going to bless this event apparently as well. Breaks the bonds. 15, what's he going to do?
Then he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey and put out his hands and took it, and with it he struck 1,000 men. And Samson said, "With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps with the jawbone of a donkey, have I struck down 1,000 men."
So Samson takes what he finds on the ground, a jawbone of a donkey, a carcass, so again, violating the Nazarite vow, I don't care, picks it up and beats down 1,000 men. Okay, this is like Shamgar and his ox goad, like, "All right, this is what I got. I'll beat you all down with it. So I'll beat you with a stick. I'll beat you with the jawbone of a donkey." 1,000 people. 1,000 people. That's insane. That room holds packed 800. That's a bunch of freaking people. Like, wow. And yet, it's all about him. It's all about his pride. All about him exacting revenge so that he can look good. Came about when he had finished speaking, he threw the jawbone from his hand, named the place Ramoth-Lehi, which means the hill of the jawbone. So he's now making a monument to his victory. Like, look at me, I'm going to make a statue of myself. And then he became very thirsty. Again, flesh, flesh, flesh. Thirsty, hunger, eat, whatever. This is Samson. You have given this great deliverance. Verse 18, by the way. First time we see this with Samson.
Then he became very thirsty. So he cried to the Lord and said, "You have given this deliverance by the hand of your servant.
shall die of thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised.
Yeah, so now Samson's going to pray, right? We've never seen this from him, ever. And now he prays. And what does he basically ask for? Yeah. What is the nature of how he prays to God? Who is God to him?
A supplier.
He's a supplier. You're a vending machine, okay? I pull on J20, and you give me Aquafina, okay? That's how his relationship with God works. This is it. So he's selfish. There's no... He wants God to step in and fix his situation, but he's certainly not going to submit to God. He's certainly not going to follow God. He's not going to obey God. That's his heart, okay?
And his reasoning, too, is like, since I'm so great...
Yeah, yeah. God, you have to do this, right? You know, in some ways, you think about this, how horrible would it be to know your destiny, right? To know this is what you're going to become one day. I mean, you see that in Samson. He knows that. He just... God gave him a glimpse into his future. You're going to be a hero. Great. And I can do no wrong. You have to use me. I cannot die, right? I can drive 190 miles an hour down the 168. I can't die, right? I mean, it's you see what would happen to all of us if we knew. There's just an arrogance and a pridefulness that comes as a result of knowing that stuff. And boy, he's jacked. So that's the idea, okay? Keep going. Well, keep going to 19.
And God split open the hollow place that is at Lehi, and water came out from it, and when he drank, his spirit returned, and he revived. Therefore, the name of it is called Enahakor. It is at Lehi to this day.
So God answers his prayer, his selfish prayer. You want water? Okay, I gave you water. And in 20 now, notice this. This is frightening.
And he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years.
So during this season of his life, right, while he is... ruling or doing these things, he is also the judge of Israel, right? God is using this guy. That's one of the most haunting verses to me in all of Samson's story. 20 years in hardness, in disobedience, in sin, God uses this guy to lead a nation, right? Frightening to me. And it's not because Samson is, like other judges, godly and repentant. He uses him despite himself, and yet here he is. Dude, relax. You got to, yeah. Just, yeah. That's a great observation, Eric. So he is very much just a purely flesh driven guy, just like Esau was. I'm hungry. Feed me now. So, okay. Let's pause there and we'll pick up on the fall of Samson in 16 next Thursday. All right. So keep noodle on him. Let him be a good lesson to all of us.